The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology.
Now, if I may digress momentarily from the mainstream of this evening's symposium, I'd like to sing a song which is completely pointless, but is something which I picked up during my career as a scientist. This may prove useful to some of you someday, perhaps in a somewhat bizarre set of circumstances. It's simply the names of the chemical elements set to a possibly recognizable tune. There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium. And iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, and terbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, chromium, lithium, beryllium, and barium. Isn't that interesting? I knew you would. I hope you're all taking notes, because there's going to be a short quiz next period. There's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury, molybdenum and magnesium, dysprosium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium, tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium, and cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and permium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, kryptonium, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.
All right, that was the Elements song performed by Tom Lehrer, lyrics by Tom Lehrer and Dmitri Mendeleev, music by Sir Arthur Sullivan. I believe that was the Major General song from Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance. Why are we opening Inside the Black Box with that song? Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's National Chemistry Week. I can tell Bill's very excited.
Yeah.
Are you excited?
Yeah, I started my celebration on Monday.
Did you?
Yeah.
And you're going to go all the way till Wednesday. You're just going to party like it's 1999.
Like it's Chemistry Week, you know.
All right, so this is the National Chemistry Week issue of Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology here on WREK Atlanta, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovis, and as always, I'm joined by my ever-effervescent co-host, a man who measures his own personal energy level in electron volts, Bill Hunt.
How you doing?
Notice I didn't say mega electron volts or gig electron volts.
Yeah, I'm about 6 EV today. Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense for you. For your entire body, about
right.
6
yeah,
EV.
Yeah,
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. All right, so the theme of National Chemistry Week is chemistry, it's elemental. So again, that's why we started with the Elements song. And it is, and my panel will correct me if I'm not correct on this, 2009 is the 140th anniversary of the discovery of the modern periodic table by Dmitri Mendeleev. So what we're going to do today is we've got a blue ribbon panel. Bill, did you bring the blue ribbons?
I have them in my pocket.
Because they're not even going on the air until you do that.
Right.
We've got a blue ribbon panel of people who are going to talk a little bit about their research in the field of chemical sciences. Then we are going to interface via high-speed geek link via the magic of our physicist friend and member of the Office of Information Technology here at Georgia Tech, Warren Matthews. Warren, you can use Trent's mic. Are we there? Are we halfway there? I'm looking at this big panel of students wondering who these crazy people in the studio are.
Can you hear us at North Hall?
Okay,
I think that was a nod.
Is that a nod? Nod if you can hear us at North Hall High School. Okay. The instructor's nodding like yes. Mr. Potato Head. The rest of them are like, don't say anything. Maybe they'll leave us alone.
Yeah.
Okay. So we are on the air with, let me see if I can get this straight here. Kenny Childs, very enthused chemistry students. That's what I'm looking at in the monitor here at North Hall High School in Hall County, Georgia. And then are we also online with Chad Motes students at Appalachian High School in Barrow County?
They haven't come back from lunch yet.
Oh, okay, so we're delayed because of lunch. Okay, then the folks in Hall County will get in on the ground floor. All right, before we begin, let's try... I'm going to make an attempt to introduce our Blue Ribbon panel, because, ladies and gentlemen, call Guinness. We probably have more We're setting the record, I think, for the number of people squeezed into a small studio, and I think we're all glad that Bill did not eat lunch at Taco Bell today. All right, so our panel consists of David Sherrill, Associate Professor in the School of Chemistry and Biochemistry here at Georgia Tech, who does computational quantum chemistry, Christine Payne, Assistant Professor in this very same school here at Georgia Tech, who does research on reactions inside cells, Facundo Fernandez, Associate Professor in the very same chemistry school, who works on analytical techniques to figure out counterfeit drugs. He's been on our program before talking about that very thing. And David S. Gottfried, Senior Research Scientist at the Nanotechnology Research Center here at Georgia Tech. And, of course, he'll be talking about everyone's favorite topic, nanotechnology. And Vernita Lockhart from the Coca-Cola Company, who's going to talk to us about the fact that you students out there can actually use chemistry in the real world. She's the Director of Strategic Initiatives there. So Vernita is, what, the member at large? Dave is the counselor, and Dave Gottfried is the chair-elect for the local section of the American Chemical Society. Can you tell us a little bit about National Chemistry Week?
The Georgia section of the ACS has got a lot of cool stuff lined up. We started off yesterday. Some of the students here at Georgia Tech went off to Miller Grove High School and did some chemistry demonstrations there. We also had a science cafe at Fernbank Science Center on nanotechnology. Coming up tomorrow, we've got three high schools coming to visit Georgia Tech. Chemery, the group over at Emory, doing chemistry demonstrations at 5:30 in Atwood Chemistry Building. And then also on Friday, Chemery is going to have a Mole Day event outside of Emory. And then on Saturday, we got two big events going up. Fernbank Science Center is going to have kind of almost an all-day thing from 11 to 4. So drop by there. They're going to have a couple chemistry magic shows at 12 and 2. And then also for the Girl Scouts, there's going to be something at Southern Poly. It's going to be kind of a CSI-themed kind of thing. It's going to be called The Case of the Kidnapped Cookies. And all of this is, I think, on the web. And if you search for ACS GLS for Georgia Local Section, you can find the whole list.
Okay.
Is Cindy Crawford involved with the Mole Day event?
Yeah. So Bill is an electrical engineer. He was looking at you funny. Mole, of course, you know, like cookies, a dozen
mole.
Cookies, a mole of things.
Never mind.
The chemistry students are not impressed by your your joke there.
I'm not looking
at it. So we do have a link on our website, WREK.org, or insidetheblackbox.org, to the national site for National Chemistry Week. Can they find the local ones there, or?
The local list, I don't think, is on the national one, but if you just do a search for ACS GLS, it'll find the Georgia Local Section homepage, and we've got the whole list there with contact info.
And if you do go to ACS.org and look under local section websites, you can, in fact, find that.
Yeah, that's right. You can go that way.
So that's exciting. And who came up with the missing cookie thing? That's
actually something the Girl Scouts have been cooperating with the ACS to do this for the last several years. And Joanne Arsenault from SciTech kind of coordinates that, and it's been a very popular event.
Oh, wow. So, and you mentioned it was CSI-like.
Yep. They're going to use chemistry to solve the mystery.
And let me turn to the obviously over-enthusiastic, over-simulated students here at Northwell High School. So how many of you guys watch CSI? Okay. Most of the class. So I hate to break it to you folks. CSI is actual chemistry. Now, just to my left here, Facundo may not always agree, because occasionally they call him up and say, okay, what does a gas chromatograph look like? And sometimes it looks like a toaster with a coat hanger coming out of it, but he's the guy that helps them make it look realistic. And for the most part, are they kind of realistic, Facundo?
Yeah, they're pretty realistic, but sometimes they're a little bit too boring, so you need to add a couple of LEDs to make them a little bit nicer for TV. But they're pretty good.
So there it is, a toaster with LEDs on it, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so let's, at least in the first half of the program, go through some interesting application areas in chemistry. So let's going to start with David Sherrill, who does work in computational quantum chemistry. So what exactly is that, and why should these guys out in Northwell County be enthused?
It's all about simulation. So wouldn't it be cool if instead of having to actually do the experiment, you could predict what would happen ahead of time? And if you could predict it well, just imagine what you could do with a computer with, 10,000 processors. You could be running 10,000 simulations at the same time, probably the best experimentalist here can do, what, two or three experiments at the same time? So as computers are getting faster, this is actually pretty exciting. What we really want to apply this kind of stuff to is anything in chemistry, but in my group we're real interested in these kind of things that happen when drugs bind. When drugs find their target, they don't really make a chemical bond. They don't exactly make a covalent bond or ionic bond. Usually it's a non-covalent interaction. It's a non-bonded interaction. And nobody really knows exactly how these work. So the anti-Alzheimer's drug, Aricept, works this way. It doesn't form chemical bonds. It forms these kind of non-bonded interactions. And the biochemists know that, but if you ask them, how could I make this bind better if I pop off a hydrogen and put a fluorine on, would it make it bind better or stronger? And usually the answer is, we have no idea.
Oh, wow.
So through simulations, you can actually try to pick apart how this thing is really binding and what groups are more important than others and exactly what's going on. If the experiments, it's so complicated, you've got so many things going on, you can't really pick it apart. But in a simulation, you can.
Right. So
well, and the economic impact of that is currently, you hear all kind of numbers like $600 million for every new drug. You could basically cut that process a little bit shorter if you could simulate things properly.
Right, right. And sort of give insight to the experimentalists.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the dream, and all the major drug companies right now have groups of computational chemists doing these simulations.
And I think you forgot the most important thing. If you're like me and you blew up a lab in graduate school, you get to avoid doing that. You mentioned, should you put a fluorine on, right? If you've met a lot of fluorine chemists, some of them are missing fingers. Fluorine's very reactive chemistry. So if you guys out there in North Hall County, you're like me, you were not the greatest in the lab. You know, you had that lab coat stained with potassium permanganate. You know, computational chemistry is something that way back in 1966, Robert Mulliken said, someday we're going to have all these computers and that's how we're going to do it. But let's not forget the experimental part, because I think what we do, and that's what I do as well, is figure out what might be the best path, but the exact fine-tuning of these things falls to the experimentalists, because Christine was looking at you like, yeah, okay, well, we're still important here. So let's turn to Christine Payne from the School of Chemistry and Biochemistry and tell us about reactions inside cells.
Right. So I'm actually a person who does experiments, and if you think about your body, you have millions of cells, and each cell is carrying out millions of chemical reactions just so that you can stay alive. So how does the cell control those reactions? Because the cell isn't just a bag of mush where things are moving back and forth.
Bill accepted, maybe. Yeah. A lot of people call his wife calls him a bag of mush.
Yeah, that's right. It's my nickname. Yeah.
No, the cell has to carefully control all of the reactions happening inside of it. So we're trying to measure how those reactions happen, how fast, and where inside the cell. And along with that, we develop a lot of new technology. So we build microscopes to watch this happening inside cells. And we work on delivering nanoparticles into cells and understanding how nanoparticles and cells interact.
Right. So we're going to get to nanoparticles in just a minute. But first, we're going to hear from Facundo Fernandez, who's with the School of Chemistry and Biochemistry as well. And he works on analytical techniques to find out if drugs are real or counterfeit. And just at the outset, he works mainly on antibiotics, anti-malarials, right, for malarial treatment. But in our previous show, he did talk about the fact that he worked on Viagra for a while. But there is no longer Viagra in your refrigerator, correct?
Correct. We ran out, basically. We had
okay.
No more Viagra.
I don't want to know how or why you ran out.
Well, this was part of an experiment. We had a high school teacher working in my lab for a summer, and she decided to look if she could find any fake Viagra, basically. And so we ordered Viagra online, and you know, it's amazing. They just send you Viagra by the mail without a prescription. So, you know, I had to keep it in my fridge for a while. And that's why one day my wife, at that point she wasn't my wife, and she opens the fridge and she saw Viagra and she asked, why do you have that? I was like, it's part of a scientific experiment, believe it or not.
Okay, and I'm sure Bill and I will use that same excuse
right,
in the future.
Right.
So what about detecting...
Well, we basically use the same technology that was used to discover the elements or most of the elements in the periodic table, which is mass spectrometry and the isotopes. We use it for, you know, to tell people if the drugs they're finding are real or not. And many developing countries are actually counterfeit. They don't have the right active ingredient.
Wow.
That's what we do. Yeah.
All right, so Christine mentioned nanoparticles earlier, so let's turn to David S. Gottfried with the Nanotechnology Research Center. So what is this nanotechnology stuff?
I don't think there's a person on the planet with a pulse that probably hasn't heard the term nanotechnology. There's a lot of hype about it, but there's certainly a lot of hope. Essentially, nanotechnology is really the manipulation and control of material at the nanoscale, so between 1 and typically 100 nanometers in size. Just to give you a calibration, human hair is about 70 to 80,000 nanometers in diameter. So one nanometer could fit 70 to 80,000 times across the diameter of a human hair. This small size of these materials, and this is all chemistry, by the way, the small size of these materials confers some interesting behaviors on them, sometimes interesting electronic behavior, sometimes interesting optical behavior, sometimes interesting mechanical behavior. And as Christine was mentioning, sometimes the fact that the size of nanomaterials is comparable to the size of most biological material, protein and DNA and cell components, there are some interesting interactions with biology, with real biology. And so a lot of applications in nanotechnology have to do with the life sciences, mm-hmm. And particularly in medicine. What's interesting is that in the relatively short time that nanotechnology has been sort of, you know, a hot topic, commercialization of this technology has been running rampant. In 2006, there's a database of nanotechnology commercialization run by the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies, which has a website. In 2006, when they started counting, they had somewhere around 200 products that involve nanotechnology. At last counting, that list is now over 1,000 products that have nanotechnology. Some of the interesting things are 60% of those are in the health field, and that doesn't refer to some complex medical device, but most of those are cosmetics and sunscreens, having titanium dioxide nanoparticles, for example. The other thing, and this is, you had, before the show, we had talked about incorporating the elements into our little blurb here. So 29% of the products in this database involve nanosilver. And silver, that's the 47th element in the periodic table, the symbol AG for you students out there. The other interesting thing I want to mention is one of the products in this list is a power drill that you can buy at Home Depot. It's made by DeWalt. And the nanoproduct of this power drill is the battery. It has some nanolithium components in this rechargeable battery. And what's interesting is that it's made by a company called A123 Systems. It's a spinoff from MIT. And in addition to this battery for this power drill, they are also using the same technology and implementing the same technology for developing batteries for electric cars, something that will help certainly with the energy crisis. So a lot of the initial applications of nanotechnologies tend to be in the mundane areas like sunscreens and rechargeable batteries, but ultimately whatever those companies learn about those applications gets applied to mm-hmm. more interesting and important applications.
And basically, the whole basis is the fact that now that chemistry, and notice I use that word very carefully, because I agree with you, I think nanotechnology really is chemistry.
It is.
Maybe a little material science, but let's face it, they're applied chemists.
Is it material science chemistry?
Well, so the whole thing is we now can manipulate things at the nanoscale. We can make little bits of matter at the nanoscale, and fundamentally their electronic properties, their light absorptive reflective properties, like in titanium oxide, fundamentally different. So when you make the same material that we've made for hundreds of years, now in really, really small levels, they can impact everything from cosmetics to batteries because they have different properties.
That's correct.
Okay. And yeah, we'll probably get to some of the hype because there's plenty of hype on that as well. All right, let's turn to Vernita Lockhart, who's from the real world, ladies and gentlemen, the Coca-Cola company, and talk to us a little bit about chemistry and what you can do with that outside the egg-headed, propeller-headed world of academics.
Very good. Let me start off by asking, how many of you kids at North Hall drink Coke products? Coke, Diet Coke, Sprite, Fanta, Powerade? Hey, that's what I like to
see.
She
can continue talking now.
That's my commercial. Chemistry is very fundamental to everything we do at Coke, considering the fact that our reputation is based on quality. We have very extensive programs in ingredient testing as well as product monitoring. We have laboratories across the globe. These are very well-equipped laboratories where we are monitoring the quality of product that's sold on the shelves. We employ polymer chemists, analytical chemists, organic as well as inorganic chemists, because there are areas of innovation that are very important to what the company views as our future. So personally, I started off on the bench doing ingredient analysis, and this is where we got into something I'm sure is very familiar to you, lots of titrations. In fact, I got to be very good at titrating materials. Then sort of progressed on to materials compatibility, where we got into some of the gas chromatographic techniques and liquid chromatographic techniques and some sensory, which when I was in school, I really didn't learn a lot about sensory, but learned a whole lot about it at Coca-Cola. And now we're putting it all together in the area of food safety for our consumers, you, as well as our other customers in this arena of foods.
So just to put that in perspective, a lot of people that major in chemistry or related things like chemical engineering, they think they're going to work for Dow, DuPont, ExxonMobil. Many of them will, but you will be working for companies like Coca-Cola and Borden and Frito-Lay and companies you would never normally think of as associated with chemistry. And in case you're thinking they're not doing, you know, broad, sophisticated work in chemistry at Coca-Cola, they actually have, or at least had, a computational chemist who was actually looking at the structure of some of the molecules in the ingredients, in particular sweeteners, at Coca-Cola. So even companies that you don't think of as chemical do some very sophisticated chemistry work. All right, so we've got everybody introduced. We've talked about various topic areas. Bill, you look like you want to add something here. You're just sitting there vegged out. Okay, they can see you, so you should actually pretend you're awake. That's
I'm
all
awake.
I'm saying. So, all right, so I'm looking at Warren. We're hooked up, but the students seem utterly comatose. Okay, now they're laughing. You know, I just
invite
pay no attention to the bald man on the screen.
Should we invite them to chime in with a question when they have one?
We could. Do they have any questions, or would they be throwing stuff at us if it weren't a geek link?
I told them to feel free to heckle you all they want.
Yes.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah.
So why don't we turn that over to the students at Northall High School and see if, in fact... Pardon? Barrow County's on as well? All right, so we are voice switched,
yes,
right?
Yes, we're here.
Okay, so in order to switch the video, someone needs to yell something out. So if we could have the instructors from either Northall or Barrow yell out that we've got a question, it'll switch over.
This is Chad at Barrow County. We've got some kids with some questions if you want to take them.
Okay, yeah, that's why we're here, Chad.
Hey. All right, guys, who's up? All right. Hold the bottom of it.
Okay, remember this is a live show. That's all I'm saying.
How long did it take to develop the proper formula for Coke?
Okay, so not everyone has headphones on. So the question was, how long did it take to develop the proper formula for Coke?
Yes.
Okay.
That's part of our secret.
She could tell you, but she may have to kill you afterwards.
Exactly. You know, I really could not tell you. I don't know. But one of the things that I think that makes people fall in love with Coke is that we do have quite a bit of mystique along our flagship brand. And all of the ingredients as well as the secrets on formulation are part of that mystique. So you have to come work for us. And and then maybe you'll be able to learn a little bit more and share more.
Well, that's also an interesting business aspect, too. So there are several ways to protect industrial knowledge. One is patent it. And if Coke had patented the formula back in 1890 or whatever it was, after 17 years, it would have been widely available to everybody. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of the trade secret aspect. So there's sort of two different ways: either tell everybody and then you've got a leg up on protecting it, or don't tell anybody and hold it secret. And they opted for that,
which a lot of chemical companies do. Mm-hmm. So it's very common in the chemical industry. Do we have another question from Barrow County?
Yes, sir. This is another question about Coke. what does Coke do to your body, like digestive system? Doesn't it, does it do anything bad to it?
All right, so did you get that question? Okay, she wants to know, digestively, what does Coca-Cola do to your body?
Actually, digestively, it is not doing anything that juices and milk and other beverages that you are consuming would do. You know, we've done extensive research on all of the reactions related to Coca-Cola, and I can assure you, I've fed it to my children, or I drink it myself. There is absolutely nothing detrimental about any of our products.
So I've fed it to my dog, actually. So the thing you got to realize about Coca-Cola is it's relatively dilute, yeah. Right? That a lot of what you're getting when you're drinking Coca-Cola is water. Right.
99.9% water.
Right. I think we got another question right behind you. And for those of you listening, we're video linked to two high schools in Georgia here. That's who we're talking to.
Go ahead with question.
I have a question for all of y'all. I was just wondering, how did chemistry get its own radio show? How did all this happen? How did all y'all get a job doing this?
Because chemistry is cool. Could we all agree on that? Chemistry is cool, despite the fact that we may not be. Chemistry is cool.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
So the question was, how did chemistry get its own radio show? So we do this weekly, Wednesdays at noon. You can hear us on 91.1 FM in Atlanta or at WREK.org. But we've done many shows on chemistry. We've probably had four or five chemists on the program before. Facundo's been on the program before. But we're doing this specifically on chemistry because it's National Chemistry Week. So do I detect a note of you guys don't think chemistry is cool? Let's see. Okay. Ray.
Is it
okay.
Cool? Well, see, the deal with Austin over here is he thinks that athletes aren't nerds, but he's an athlete who is a nerd, too. So he's getting to the realize that chemistry is cool.
So at Georgia Tech, we have a lot of athletes that are nerds, right? UGA, maybe not, right? I mean, Dave went to UGA. It has an excellent quantum chemistry program, medicinal chemistry, but I'm guessing not too many of you guys played football.
Definitely not.
Okay. All right. Do we have any more questions?
We've got a question from a football player here at North Hall High School that was interested in counterfeit drugs.
Okay.
Not interested. Okay, whatever.
All right. How popular are counterfeit drugs, and what is the most popular counterfeit drug?
So
the question was how popular are counterfeit drugs, and I don't think that's quite the right term. It's more how extensive
right, and what are some of the most popular counterfeit drugs,
and that's a really good question. So it depends where you buy them. So if you buy it's a good question. So if you buy online, the chances are pretty good, you know, that you're going to get a fake. It's about 50%. So if you go to any internet site and you try to buy a fake, it's been studied recently by buying a lot of medicines that, yes, you can. It's pretty bad, the situation. If you go to a pharmacy store, the chances of finding a fake are pretty low in the U.S. It's not about 2% or 1%, except for some exceptional cases. But in developing countries, in Africa and Southeast Asia, the percentage is between 20 and up to 90%, depending on the type of medicine. So it can be really bad.
Yeah, and to clarify, and this is from a previous time when Facundo was on the show, you have doctors trying to treat patients for malaria in Africa, and you know, they don't do analysis on the drugs that you get, but the drugs that they're using to treat malaria victims are actually sugar pills and won't do anything about malaria. So it's really
is deplorable.
You know, it's not an advantageous thing to buy the counterfeit ones. It's counterfeit in the sense that it's fake and it doesn't do medically what it's supposed to do. If you look at some of the issues that you were talking about, the intricacies of interaction between the drugs and the body, and then you just throw that all out the window, it doesn't work. So you've got a lot of people that are dying from malaria because of these counterfeit drugs. And you're on a Gates Foundation fellowship. So he's on a Gates Foundation fellowship, which is looking at this because it's a worldwide problem.
So I guess just one follow-up question on that. So Facundo, you use mass spectrometry.
Correct.
So what is mass spectrometry, and how does that help you figure out
if
something's counterfeit?
Well, basically, mass spectrometry, or mass spec, how we call it, is one of the most sophisticated scales in the world. So it allows you to measure molecules, measure the mass of a molecule or a group of molecules. And the way that we use it is if you have the right active ingredient or, you know, in a drug, we see that the mass of the right molecule is there and it shows up on the screen of your computer. But if the drug is fake, then you don't see the right mass. And that tells you right away that you're not looking at the right product. And so it's a very powerful technique.
Right. So I've never heard it put that way, but you're absolutely right. It literally is the most sensitive scale. You're kind of like shooting it out and watching it bend in a
Correct.
Field, but that's how you
We do it in a very sophisticated way. We put a charge on the molecules. We make them fly through electrical or magnetic fields. We look them as they fly, and we measure their arrival times, but the bottom line is that we just measure the mass.
Right. And mass spec is commonly used in CSI, in case you want
to. Well, and then how much does a mass spec piece of equipment cost, and how much training does it take to be able to use that equipment?
Well, the most sophisticated instruments can be several million dollars, and it takes, you know, many years to train. But the trend now is to make them cheaper and make them portable. So you can, there are companies selling portable instruments for about $50,000, which is not that much for a scientific instrument. So hopefully in the future you can take one of these little shoebox-sized mass specs in the field and you can run, you know, just check to see if the drugs are fake or not.
All right, do we got more questions?
We've got another one here at North Hall.
With all the H1N1 going around, have there been a lot of counterfeit vaccines for that?
Sorry. Only half of us have headphones on. With all the H1N1 virus going, the vaccines going around, have there been counterfeit vaccines for that?
Very good point. Not that I heard of, but and hopefully not. What I have heard of a few years ago, you may remember there was a big scare on influenza about, I think it was late 05 or beginning of 06, and there was some fake Tamiflu showing up and being shipped around the world. So that was of a lot of concern, and we developed a method. Actually, David here helped us with a method to screen for potentially fake Tamiflu.
Right, with regard to the these vaccinations, right, most of them are simply solutions of either weakened or dead or somehow changed viruses. And it sort of gives you a perspective that many drugs are small, well, sometimes complicated, but relatively small molecules. Then you can move up to viruses, which are sort of just, how do we want to describe that? Just the wimpiest kind of cell, kind of DNA inside of a protein coat. It's a little more complicated than that.
It is, but you could think of that as just a biological nanoparticle. It's about the same size as nanoparticles people are interested in.
And then we go up to cells.
Virus considered living now? Have they been upgraded a lot? They seem to be on the outskirts of, I mean, I don't know why they shouldn't
Much
be considered
like Bill,
living.
Borderline.
You know?
They're just on the edge between alive and not alive because they'll have DNA or RNA inside of them, but they can't survive on their own.
Right.
Okay, so they don't have these other little compartmentalized things where reactions occur like organelles, like mitochondria that would be in a cell to give them their independent energy. They need the energy from a host.
Right. So the virus would take advantage of the cell.
Right. So I think you want to keep that in mind, that chemistry studies everything from small molecules with a few atoms in them to bigger molecules like in drugs to viruses to cells. Chemistry is everywhere. That's why we have our own show on chemistry today. I'm sticking with that theory.
Yeah.
Any more questions?
Sure, we have one from Barrow County.
Okay.
Okay, so I have a question of Coke because I drink like a case like a week, and it's
you should
all
stop that.
Coke.
Okay, sorry. Could you finish the question?
And I read a study that said that aspartame is actually like really bad for you, and that people have gotten like brain tumors from it. And I'm like, I'm gonna be that person if it's true.
Okay, so the question was, is aspartame, right, the dipeptide of what, phenylalanine and aspartic acid, which is coming, which is that actually even used in Coca-Cola anymore?
Well, we do still have some aspartame in the beverage, and, you know, we get this question quite a bit, and, you know, I commend you for asking it, and I would suggest, too, that you go out to our website, We have done lots of studies, and so many other companies have done studies looking at the safety of aspartame, and it is safe. No questions about it. There is no data out there to support any sort of detrimental effects of aspartame, particularly when we start talking about the levels in our beverages. You know, I think when they've done studies and they've looked at people or animals being fed 100 pounds of chemicals over two-hour periods, things like that. I'm speaking here that's kind of out of my area, but things that I've heard or read through the company. So I really can tell you that the research shows that there are no detrimental effects to any of the ingredients in our project, in our products. And I encourage you to just go out to the website and take a look at it, because it's all there. It's part of us being transparent about what's in our beverages.
So along those lines, that's a really good question, because science is filled with uncertainty, right? There's so many things that we work with. I've got to go talk to the vinyl industry next week, and trust me, this weighs heavily on my mind, because they don't like polyvinyl chloride in general. Science is always looking. They're always waiting to see. There's always a new study coming out. And the best example I can think of this is the fact that, okay, so I'll speak for the old people here. Way back in the 60s and the 50s, I'm looking at you too, Bill, yeah. So don't give me that nod. In the 50s, it was cyclamates, and we banned cyclamates in this country. But they kept using them in Europe, and they used them for another 3-4 decades, and no one really had a problem. Then we banned sodium saccharin, what, in the 60s or the 70s? Because we did exactly that. We gave the equivalent of hundreds of pounds to a human to rats. We banned it. People had sodium saccharin. They used it for another 30 years in Europe. Nobody ever really got sick. And admittedly, if you use large quantities of any of these things, all sorts of bad things are going to happen. But you use natural sucrose, same thing's going to happen, right? Rots your teeth, mm-hmm. can give you diabetes, messes up your metabolism. The one nice thing about aspartame is it's just two regularly occurring amino acids, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So under bizarre conditions, you can make anything produce whatever the heck you want. When this breaks in half, the only people that have danger from it are people that are phenylketonurics that cannot process lots of phenylalanine, right? So that's a known pathology that the average person doesn't
so
know.
So probably the day that all of you were born, there was a test done at the hospital to see if you were allergic to that.
Right. And now the latest one is sucralose, which looks just like sucrose, mm-hmm. but they put chlorines where the hydroxyl groups are, so it doesn't bind, but it still has the nice same shape, so it gets in that receptor in your taste bud. You know, studies indicate there's nothing wrong with that, but only time will tell. I just don't think we know. But I think of all those, aspartame's probably the least threatening.
Well, part of the point this gets to, a couple of different things, is the... you know, there's a lot of stuff out there on the web, some based in fact, some not. And then beyond that, when you do these experiments with exposures, they try to speed up the process. And so they'll give a mouse,
tons.
The equivalent of a pound of this a day for a human, and then say, look what happened. But if you had a pound of salt a day, you'd keel over. So, right. I mean, it's really the extrapolation is a matter of difficulty, I would say.
And Bill drinks the equivalent of what, 80 gallons of
iced tea
naturally
a day. I want sweated iced tea. I want sweated
so
iced tea when I wear it.
That explains the way he looks, actually. Yeah. Let me also mention to my colleagues here, because we've got two engineers answering chemistry questions, which is always a dangerous thing. And feel free to chime in anytime you have a comment on any one of these things. Any chiming in? All right, we got another question.
We had a question here at North Hall.
Okay.
Go ahead.
In a CDC report I read recently, other techniques for detecting counterfeit drugs were mentioned, and they were techniques that were used mainly in the field. And I was just wondering if you were familiar with any other techniques.
So there's a CDC report recently about different techniques for detecting counterfeit drugs. what is out there in terms of the field use right now for counterfeit drugs?
Yeah, was it a CDC or an FDA, maybe, report? But the CDC has several web pages about counterfeit, different types of counterfeit drugs. And that's actually a friend of mine, Mike Green at the CDC, fantastic guy. Also a great musician, plays the harmonica.
See, but we're not all completely geeky.
Yeah, you would be surprised. And but in terms of techniques, let's go from the basic one to the more sophisticated one. And the basic way of telling if a drug is fake is by looking at the package. And that doesn't require any chemistry. So you look at the package, are there any spelling errors? Is there, the right color? And the next way is you just take a tablet, for example, you dissolve it, and you see you can make a colorimetric reaction with some specific reagent, and you develop color. If the drug is real, you get color. If the drug is not real, you don't get color. And that's basic chemistry. But the problem is that you need one test for each one of the drugs that you're looking for. And the next way is a little bit more expensive, is using some sort of spectrometer. You could use an infrared spectrometer that measures the absorbance or reflectance of different molecules in the infrared, or you could use a Raman spectrometer. And the nice thing is that these are portable. They are the size of a laptop computer, so you can take these to the field. And then from there, the techniques become lab-based, and you can use chromatographic techniques like HPLC, a high-pressure chromatographic technique, or you can use mass spec, which is the one that we use, and that gives you a lot of information, but of course it comes at a certain cost.
And describe what chromatography is.
Well, chromatography, it is like a chemistry test. Chromatography basically is a separation technique that is based on the differential interaction of molecules between a mobile phase and a stationary phase. The mobile phase can be a liquid in HPLC, and the solid phase is usually a column that is packed with some solid particles.
So they pass through the column at different speeds based on molecularly what they are.
Correct.
See, I was trying to get the chemist to actually answer the chemistry question, and he balked on it. Go ahead.
Okay. Any more questions? That's all we're doing now is answering questions.
I've got a question for all of you, actually. If you could give one defining moment in your life that motivated you to go into science or to go into chemistry or just in science in general, what would you say that defining moment was?
And that was not a planted question, by the way. But
so
a very good
repeat
one.
Repeat the question for the
okay,
panelists.
So the question was, what is the defining moment that led you to think you wanted to go into science? Should we start at the end?
I'll go. And this is not a cliche, but it really had to be in high school chemistry. And I still remember this is, back in the dark ages, when you were allowed to do these kinds of things. My high school chemistry teacher, Mr. Tom Spidel, who I don't think is any longer with us, but he did a chemical reaction where he demonstrated instantaneous combustion, and it was pretty dramatic. I mean, I don't think they're allowed to do explosions in high school chemistry anymore. I just remember that really vividly, and he was a really terrific teacher, so be good to your chemistry teachers.
For me, it was high school chemistry. I was in the 11th grade. My science teacher, chemistry professor, was Salim Itani. He was visiting our high school for a period of 1 year, and I became fascinated in the balancing of equations. I just thought that was the coolest thing around, and decided when I went off to college that I liked it so much, I took it in senior year too, but I was a different professor, that if I survived and managed to do well, that I would major in it. Well, lo and behold, there were so many other aspects of it that just motivated me to continue till I just fell in love with the area, and before I knew it, I was a senior and had taken every chemistry course at my college. So that's how I got here.
What I really liked about chemistry was, in chemistry and in most of science, there's a right answer. So, you write your English paper, and maybe your professor likes it, and maybe they don't. But in chemistry, there's a right answer, and you either, you got it or you didn't. And when I was in high school, I thought that was so cool that you can do these little problems ahead of time, and then you can go in the lab and do the experiment. And if you've done everything right, it actually matches up. So that's one of the things I really like about it.
All right. So I hated high school chemistry. It was probably my least favorite class in high school was chemistry. I did like math a lot, and I did like physics a lot. And when I went to college, I wasn't a chemistry major. I was a physics major, and I changed my mind. I became a history major. I really like history. But I had to take a chemistry class as a requirement, and this was in my second year of college. And once I was in college, and I saw it in a different way, and I saw more of the physical chemistry, things like quantum mechanics and kinetics, then I thought I really liked it. But I took every chemistry class, but I took them all in 2 years of college because I switched in very late.
So. Okay, so there you see the diversity of backgrounds here. So I'm not a chemist. I'm a chemical engineer. And when I was a freshman, I was one of those geeks on the debate team. Do you guys have those folks there? Right, and most guys on the debate team want to become lawyers because they want to make that argument in front of court. Then sophomore year, I took chemistry from Duane Linneman, who also blew things up. He did that sodium hydroxide iodine thing and put it underneath someone's chair to just spontaneously went off. And I don't think you could do that anymore. Yeah,
Chad, do you do explosions anymore?
Are you allowed to?
We do quite a bit. I actually have my AP kids come into this group and do all kinds of demos. They're going to do demos for the school on Friday.
Wow,
so
cool.
For chemistry week, during lunches. So,
right.
You know, a kid the other day did a thermite reaction. They've blown up hydrogen.
Wow, thermite.
I towed the line a little bit. So, you know, but that's what $1 million worth of legal coverage from Page is for, right?
Okay, there you go. But like I said, much like Dave, it was my high school chemistry teacher. Then I became a chemical engineer because that was back in the heyday of sort of shale oil. And what we found is basically the difference between a chemist and a chemical engineer is a chemical engineer knows 30% less chemistry but gets paid 20% more because they're willing to look like a geek in a hard hat and steel toed boots.
I did my undergrad in Argentina, where I'm from, and things are a little bit less regulated than in the U.S., so we could buy really complicated chemistry sets when I was a little kid, and I decided that rather than reading the instructions and following the procedures and doing one experiment at a time, I was just going to, I was about 10 years old, I was just going to mix everything together at once in a big bottle and wait. And I did that. And I'm not sure exactly what the chemical reactions were, but it was a really interesting mix. And the colors inside the bottle were beautiful. And I still remember the colors. They were, you know, shining in the sun. And for a minute, I thought that all this mix of things and colors and flowing inside this bottle was something that was alive. And that made me think that if it was possible to go from chemistry to something that it's alive. And so I asked my dad about it. And he looked at me funny, but he's a physicist, so not too funny. And he said, well, nobody really knows yet. And I think that really got me interested in chemistry, that there's a path probably from chemistry to something that's alive.
Didn't you set your house on fire?
I set my cat on fire.
Yeah. I set my couch on fire.
Okay, that can't be approved by the SPCA or anything like
right,
that.
Right.
We don't recommend setting small pets on fire.
Yes.
Now, Bill's an electrical engineer, but you do some chemistry, do you?
Yeah, yeah.
You?
So for my inspiration, National Lampoon had just come out when I was in high school, and there was an advertisement with a pretty girl, and it said, girls dig guys who know calculus. So that was kind of, it's like being in a rock band, you know.
And so
that turned out to not really be true. Yeah.
Whoa.
But no, I actually really enjoyed, I was kind of good at a lot of things, but not great at anything. And I liked math and I liked physics. And, I was sort of in both and then decided, well, engineering, you can actually apply that and get a job with it and still use math every day. So that was sort of my way of being able to use math every day.
And just to put Bill's comment in context, according to the American Chemical Society, at least it was last year, more than half of the undergraduate chemistry majors in the United States are women. Here at Georgia Tech, you guys hover around 51% every time I check in with you. You're always around the halfway point, usually in the direction of a few more women than men. So I mentioned that to people, and you know, Bill's in electrical engineering, where you're what, 10% women? Biomedical engineering and chemical engineering, which are related to chemistry, we're between 35% and 45% women in that chemical engineering field. So if you're interested in chemistry or chemistry related science, I always tell this to women so they feel as though, okay, there will be my peers there. And invariably there's some guy in the back of the room saying, yeah, forget about that mechanical engineering, I'm majoring in chemistry or chemical engineering. But times, they are changing. And I did notice this, there are three candidates for the president of the American Chemical Society, and they're all women. So I was just voting the other day.
They're in a lot of those fields, it's mainly women.
So more questions?
Any questions? Gracie has one.
Okay, so my question is about Coca-Cola. And I read that a while ago it was used to, like, help out stomach aches, like, settle your stomach. And does Coke still have any medical purposes?
Did you get that question? It was used in the past to settle stomachs, and does it have any medical purposes?
You know, I've heard that before, but in the 30-plus years I've been with Coke, I have not seen anything or any research that says we have medicinal qualities. But if it makes you feel better, then, you know, it's okay with us. But there is nothing in there that the medical society would say has medicinal properties in our beverage. It is strictly for refreshment and for enjoyment.
Does it make you feel better? It settles my stomach, I'll be honest. There it is, you know. Okay, we got two thumbs up.
Okay, good.
All right, there you go.
Very good.
And that's something that's very interesting in science. I mean, this is how next week we're going to have a guy who wrote a book about how politicians manipulate science. Scientists try to do that good control experiment where they do it without the material and see if it really makes a difference. This whole idea of a placebo effect, that somehow you take something, right? Counterfeit drug, for example, makes you feel better because you feel as though you actually did something. And as much as we like to think we have, you know, a better technical acumen than the guys on Mythbusters, they actually do a decent negative control experiment every once in a while to show that, you know, without it, it doesn't really make a difference, whereas you think it does because it just makes you feel better. But like I said, it makes me feel better. So any more questions?
Amanda has a question.
Well, I watch a lot of movies, and I always see that nanotechnology is referred to as, like, living robots or something.
Ooh, so the question was, nanotechnology is often referred to these nanobots. Right. And what do we think about that?
Yeah, that's some of the nano hype that I referred to earlier. And actually, the nanobots comes from a 1986 book written by Eric Drexler, who was at MIT at the time. And it's kind of gotten into popular literature. One of my favorite authors of science fiction is Michael Crichton, and he wrote a book about 10, 15 years ago called Prey, which was based on this idea of the gray goo that Drexler postulated. And I think I stopped reading his books after that because it was so, I found it so filled with scientific inaccuracies. You just have to be careful about what, you know, you believe and what's out there in the popular press. I don't think anybody right now is producing any, you know, nanobots that are going to go around and take over the world. Things tend to be on a more mundane level, like individual particles that have interesting properties.
So, the whole gray goo thing. There's a couple things like the first and second law of thermodynamics that sort of get in the way of these nanobots reproducing and just covering the planet with gray goo. And I'm glad that Dave pointed out that's a classic example of all the hype. But if you think about it, the nanobots, tiny nanometer-sized things that target particular things and induce certain reactions, those are drugs. Those are molecules. Those are polymer films. I mean, we use these in microelectronics for years. So in a sense, I'm going to give chemistry the credit for nanotechnology. We've been using it for years. We call it chemistry, but we got so low, we actually had a unit change from micrometer to nanometer. Suddenly, it was a new cool buzzword. And to be honest, most of the hype things you see, if you go look up nanotechnology seminar or conference, a lot of those are put together by business people and lawyers. And keep in mind that not only do drugs get counterfeited, so do nano products, right? There was a big thing. There was a German cleaning product that used nanoparticles, and people inhaled it. Well, to be honest, if you inhale micron-sized particles, you're going to have respiratory distress. And it turns out they looked at the particles, and they weren't nanometer scale. They were micrometer scale. They were 1,000 times or more bigger. So that's a question for Dave. Is there regulation of this stuff?
There are starting to be some standards, like ASTM, which is one of the standards agencies, is starting to write standards so that when we say something is nano, a nanoparticle, what do we mean by that? And, you know, what are the ways to characterize that and properly? The other example that I actually just learned about yesterday is there was a product, a bandage, that was impregnated with silver nanoparticles, or so the manufacturer claimed. And it turns out that's now off the market because they were cutting their nano silver with aluminum. So it didn't have the same antibacterial properties that real nano silver would have. Whether they were doing that intentionally or that was part of just the manufacturing process, I don't know. But that's been taken off the market. The other one that I when I talk about this to people is I was on an airplane and reading through the Delta the Sky Mall magazine that has all the products, and I came across a product for a UV disinfectant light that termed itself nano UV. And I've been a chemist for 25 years, and I have no idea what nano UV is.
Well, listen, a UV photon is about the size,
And maybe that's what a few hundred nanometers, and maybe that's what they're referring to. I don't think so.
Okay, so the silver stuff, though. I mean, we've known for 1,000 years that silver had antibacterial properties. By making it really, really small, does that help the delivery of this thing?
Or? I think it has to do with surface area.
Okay.
So as you make things smaller, the same mass will give you a much greater surface area.
Okay, but just a word of warning to our assembled students that you got to be careful with that. Wasn't there some guy who took a silver salt solution, drank it, and now his head is blue?
I think his entire body
is blue. Yeah, his entire body is blue.
Yeah.
So you may want to avoid that.
Yeah.
All right, so we're getting down near the end of the show where we need to wrap up. So let's thank all our students out at Appalachee High School and North Hall High School. Thanks for joining us, folks.
Thanks, guys.
And now's the time where we try to wrap up and summarize what have we learned. I'm going to take a crack at this, and then anyone chime in with this, and you guys can give us a thumbs up or thumbs down to see if we've done it particularly well. So, I learned something new that I knew all about mass spec, but mass spec is basically the world's smallest scale. I never thought about it that way, which was great. Aspartame, of all the stuff that we use for sweeteners, probably the most natural and maybe the most safest. I'm worried about the sucralose. I don't know what's happening with this chlorinating thing of sucrose. But right now, studies say it's completely safe. Computational quantum chemistry avoids blowing things up in the lab like I did, right? And gives insight to the experimentalists like Christine and some of the other folks here to use that to guide their experimentation, things like that. There's sort of a hierarchy of chemistry, right? We start with small molecules, then we get to bigger molecules, then we get to things like viruses, which, like Bill, border on the edge of live versus
can't
not
really
alive. Then organelles, cells, that's the sort of thing that Christine studies. Chemistry is done in the real world, like Coca-Cola, right? And it actually impacts your everyday life through products like Coca-Cola and a lot of things from the new field of nanotechnology and chemistry. A lot of hype, but it's actually out there in lots of products. So chemistry isn't just something us eggheads do in the lab. There's a tremendous diversity, not only of chemistry that we saw here, but of backgrounds. Right, so there is no one geeky guy that wears a pocket protector. I don't have one here with me. But all our panelists will be receiving the official Dr. Pete plastic vinyl pocket protector for joining us here today. So it's not just one group. It can be athletes, right?
Well, and the other thing, too, is that there's just such a wide range of occupations you can get into with a chemistry background. And, I think that you continually can be amazed. So in your day-to-day work, you kind of just astonished by what you continue to learn.
Right. So find the area of chemistry or science in general that you find interesting. And then, trust me, If you've ever met someone that does a job that they don't like for 5 or more years, they have a certain look about them. None of the people on this panel have that look about them because they do what they do. You know, they make a living. You know, that's perfectly fine. But they do it because they like it. So, mm-hmm. you know, people that do right. science do it for just that reason.
Yep.
I guess finally we've learned that the gray goo is nothing to worry about. Right, I would certainly agree with that. And that there are lots of cool things going on this week for National Chemistry Week. You can find that at the ACS website, on our website, insidethablackbox.org. Or if you search for GLS, the Georgia Local Section of ACS, you can find out a lot about the stuff that Dave mentioned earlier. What else did I leave out? Any final parting thoughts? Any advice to high school seniors or something like that?
Let me just throw in one other thing. Since it's National Chemistry Week, I'd like to point out that everything is made out of chemicals, right? If you really stop to think about it, this table in front of me is made out of chemicals. The air we breathe is mostly nitrogen and oxygen.
My stepmother's made out of chemicals.
Yes, that's for sure.
So, you know, if you ever hear anybody say, oh, you know, well, that's bad because that's chemicals, hey, it's all chemicals.
Right. So there's no such thing as chemical-free. Right, mm-hmm. And just because it's made in a lab versus made in nature doesn't necessarily make one better than the other, because there's plenty of stuff in nature that will really mess you up.
Right.
So, all right, well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on the program. Just a reminder, next week our guest will be Dave Mooney, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Republican War on Science. And he'll be talking about his latest book, which he co-authored with Cheryl Kirshenbaum, entitled Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy is Threatening Our Future. And I'm going to be asking him about a question that is very relevant to high school students here in Georgia. That is the fact that just recently, the Georgia Board of Regents approved yet another reduction in the core science requirement for the University System of Georgia, and I'm not happy about it. So I'll be getting Dave's questions or Dave's opinion on that. If you have got a question or comment for us here at Inside the Black Box or a suggestion for a future show, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. This program is a production of the WREK Studios on the campus of Georgia Tech. Trent, you got that song?
Yep.
Queued up for me? All right, so Trent's going to be taking us out with a newer version of that Tom Lehrer Element song. It's by Jesse Dangerously, from an album entitled, get this, Bill, you're going to love this, How to Express Your Dissenting Political Viewpoint Through Origami. Please join us next week on Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
Someone told you there were only 4 elements? I think Tom Lehrer thought of a few more.
Antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, and radium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and actinium, and radium, gold, octinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium, yttrium, and terbium, actinium, rubidium, boron, gadolinium, niobium, rubidium, neptunium, and silicon, and silver, and barium, bismuth, chromium, beryllium, and barium.
If that's not even it, though.
Cause there's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and radium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury and molybdenum and magnesium and dysprosium, scandium, cerium, cesium, red vanadium and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium, tantalum, magnesium, titanium, tellurium, and cadmium, and calcium, and chromium, and curium, sulfur, californium, and permium, and berkelium, and osmium, and dilithium, isinium, nobelium, and argon, krypton, and rayon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, bubble, copper, tungsten, and sodium. These are the only ones that were due to come to Harvard. There may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.
Oh, I guess, you know, like 10 or so have, but y'all get the gist? Think bigger.